Time now is 3:40, February the 6th. We have with us Senator McGuire, Huggins, Stedman, Willikowski, and Senator Wagner from Kenai. Joining us soon to follow will be Senator Stevens and Senator Green. Today on our agenda is we'll hear from TransCanada, the only applicant deemed conforming. And here is Senator Green. Now, the presenter will be via remote, Mr. Tony Palmer, who's the Vice President of Alaska Business Development for TransCanada. And he'll be participating via teleconference, most likely from Seattle, SeaTac Airport, where he's weathered in or whatever, can't get here. And I would like to, at this time, welcome those Alaskans that are listening on gavel to gavel, and remind you that if you want to take a look at the applications, that they are, in fact, on the state website. And I'd like to ask Patty to introduce herself here in a moment, who will be running the slideshow so that Tony can speak to those. And remind each of you that next Monday, continue on our quest for putting information forward for Alaskans, we will hear from the Port Authority. So with that, Mr. Palmer, you there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Yeah. Tony, if you would put yourself on the record, and we have your introductory header up at this point in time, and Patty is locked and loaded, and we'd be proud to hear from you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tony Palmer. I'm the Vice President of Alaska Development for TransCanada Corporation, and I apologize today to being waylaid by the airlines. I was intending to be there in person, but was unfortunately unable to do so. So very pleased that you could accommodate me presenting remotely. If you're ready, Mr. Chairman, I will just launch into my presentation, and I will be pleased to take questions as I proceed through the presentation or at the end, at your pleasure.
Okay, very good. And I will just do the prompting. Obviously, we can't raise our hand. So with that, please proceed.
Well, thank you, Patty. If I could ask you to turn to slide 2, please. Firstly, I thought I would take the opportunity to thank the committee for inviting TransCanada today to present with regards to TransCanada's GI application. As you know, TransCanada was aware that this was the transparent process that both the administration and the legislature had approved in 2007 to advance the project. And TransCanada made the decision in late fall of 2007 to make an application and prepared that application and submitted it on November 30th. I'll speak to that application in some detail as I go through the presentation, but I thought for the committee as well as for those who may be listening in, I would give a brief introduction of TransCanada, what we do, who we are, and some comparison of the scale of this project relative to our existing business. So this slide tries to do that. The map illustrates our existing system. That's the I apologize for not being able to see the map, but I have it in front of me in black and white. Our system is the brighter lines on the map, and you can see that our system really extends across Canada and across the United States as well. And on the right-hand side, you'll see a table. And TransCanada's business primarily is we're a natural gas transmission pipeline. We own 36,500 miles of pipe, and I would compare that to the proposed project, which is some 1,700 miles of pipe, just under 5% of our existing mileage. I'd also tell you that we're not only a large Canadian pipeline company, we're one of the largest U.S. interstate pipelines. We have some 12,000 miles of U.S. pipeline in the ground. And I've just illustrated for you on this slide that the component of this project within the United States and Alaska would be 750 miles. Just below that, I've also illustrated the amount of compression that we hold currently, some 3.2 million horsepower as compared to the initial horsepower on this pipeline would be something in the order of 100,000, so a very small component of that. And our throughput volumes, if you look at the volumes that we move each and every day across North America, it's 15 BCF a day. And in fact, if you were to add up the individual pipes, because occasionally we move that same gas twice, it's actually something in the order of 30. But I've tried to remove any double counting here, and by so doing, we're actually moving 15 BCF a day to market across North America each and every day. This project, of course, we hope, will be in the order of 4.5 BCF a day, some one-third of our existing volume. The final initial volumes, of course, will be determined in an open season. I'd also like to highlight for you some of the projects that we've completed in our 50 years of history. TransCanada was initiated 50 years ago to build a pipeline across Canada, from Alberta to eastern Canada to Ontario and Quebec. At that time, we were a brand new company, really no substantive assets at the time. And at that point, we constructed a pipeline across Canada through some very challenging terrain, particularly across northern Ontario, some 2,300 miles, once again, a larger and longer project than the Alaska Pipeline. And in the 1990s, we completed 7,000 miles of pipeline, an expansion on our existing system in Canada and the United States. We did so on schedule and within 0.6% of budget. And lastly, you'll see on this map, I hope, a dotted line for an oil pipeline we're currently proceeding with. That dotted line goes east from Alberta to about Winnipeg and then straight south to Illinois and to Oklahoma. That's the Keystone Oil Pipeline. That has it's about 2,150 miles of new pipeline, 1,380 miles in the United States is new build, and a component in Canada which is a conversion of one of our original gas pipelines from gas service to oil. So I wanted to just take a moment by going through these credentials to show you that TransCanada's business is transporting natural gas primarily. We do not own any of the gas that we move across North America. So of this 15 BCF a day that we move each and every day, we own none of it. Just like we propose to own none of the Alaskan gas. Our proposal under AGEA and our proposal to Alaska is very similar to what we do across North America. Is we're an independent pipeline company. We're in the business of providing service to our customers who wish to transport their gas. We do not take possession of the gas. We strictly transport it for them, much like a railway company. And that's the primary fashion under which natural gas is transported across Canada and the United States each and every day, not just by TransCanada, but by other pipeline companies as well. I could ask you to turn to slide 3. Also wanted to illustrate for you an example of TransCanada's record of developing a basin. This is a series of maps of Alberta commencing when our pipeline started in 1958. Up in the top left, you'll see that we had a very modest system in 1958 in Alberta. A couple hundred miles, we were moving very small volumes, only 3 customers at the time. And as you move to the right on these maps, you'll see up through 1965, 75, 85, and then ultimately to 2005, we now have some 15,000 miles of pipe across the province of Alberta and 300 plus customers. And you can basically transport gas across the province of Alberta or into and out of our system from most of the province of Alberta. Really, the only location that you cannot is the far northeast of Alberta, where there's not a particularly gas-prone area, and of course in the national parks, if you're familiar with Alberta geography, through Banff and Jasper and Lake Louise, that's protected territory. There's no development in those areas. But I would highlight for you, if you look at our system in 1985, compare the growth in our system in the first 30 years of our operation from 1958 through 1985. I would tell you that's a striking development And we hope and expect that's what Alaskans would like to see outside of your protected regions for social or ecological or environmental reasons. I think that Alaska is looking to develop your basin broadly, not just to transport the initial 35 TCF that is proven today, but to look to transport your 135 or 235 TCF, which is sits behind that proven gas reservoir. This structure was moved forward over the last 50 years in Alberta under an independent pipeline model with rolled-in tolls, and as I've described to you, the initial customers that we had in 1958 have grown, and we now have the original customers plus new ones, small and large customers, and customers that are resident within Alberta, and marketers and local distribution companies and other corporations that really wish to have their gas transported across North America. On slide four, I also wanted to show you TransCanada's financial capacity. The estimated capital cost for this project in 2007 dollars is approximately $26 billion. If you add AFUDC, and that's just pipeline jargon for the carrying cost of money, plus cost escalation for when you actually need to spend the money, because the money will not be spent in 2007, it would be spent over the course of the next decade. If you do that, our application has a total cost when you go into service of about $33 billion. And during construction, TransCanada has indicated that we would propose to go with the 30% equity ratio the state has allowed as the maximum, and that would approximate about $10 billion. Of course, our obligation would go down once we go into service. TransCanada has indicated to be competitive that we will reduce the equity ratio down to 25% once we go into service, and I'll speak to that as I go forward. But the overall equity requirement is about $10 billion. That, of course, includes AFUDC and cost escalation. So those actual dollars will not be spent. That will be the total accumulated dollars. And I wanted to show you TransCanada's current and net cash flow. And that's in 2007. So this assumes that TransCanada's business does not grow over the next 7 to 10 years, which I can tell you we've had very good growth over the last several years, and certainly hopeful that that will continue. But I wanted to show you a comparison of our current cash flow, which is the $2.3 billion, the bar on the far left of the graph, and show you the actual expenditures of equity expected over the course of the construction period of the project and logistics. You can see that it's really only in the last year, 2017, as we go into service, where we actually even approach the net cash flows of TransCanada. And that would, of course, assume that TransCanada were to own the gas treatment plant. And if you've read our application, you would understand that TransCanada prefers that we do not own that gas treatment plant. We think there are other parties within the state of Alaska, either the three existing producers on the North Slope, perhaps other Alaskans or other parties may wish to own that facility. And I've highlighted that in these graphs as to how the equity requirement would be reduced in the event that a third party were to own that. And you're also aware, of course, that we have offered shippers participation in the equity of the project in the event that they commit threshold volumes in the initial open season. That would, once again, reduce TransCanada's equity commitment. And we also know that there may be third parties that wish to become our equity partners at some point in the future. And of course, I have not identified here that we could always go to the capital markets for an attractive project to raise equity. We did exactly that last year when we bought ANR, which was a 10,000-mile U.S. pipeline. TransCanada financed that initially with its internal cash flow, and 2 months later went to the market for capital funding. That's the normal process in any business. So I wanted to show you just that TransCanada is financially capable of financing the equity for this project, and the debt would be third-party funding. As you are aware, the U.S. government has generously offered a loan guarantee that will assist in providing the in obtaining the debt financing, and of course will improve the interest rate. So after that brief introduction, I would ask Patty to turn to slide 5. So slide 5 is straight from our application. It highlights for you the pipeline system that we would propose to build. Firstly, if you look at Alberta, if you look at the map from Alberta, the existing pre-build starts in the center of Alberta. As I recall, that's a blue solid line on the map. Looks a bit like a wishbone. And north of there, of course, is the pipeline to be built from Prudhoe Bay down to the Alberta-BC border and continuing on in that dotted line to interconnect with the pre-build. I would tell you that the Alberta hub is the most liquid market in North America. Physically, about 11 BCF a day moves on TransCanada's Alberta system, which, by the way, when you hear parties speak about the Alberta hub, that is the TransCanada system. So when parties describe it as AECO hub or the Alberta hub, they're actually speaking about TransCanada's 15,000-mile pipeline system that I showed you a couple of slides ago. Once you're on that system, you can trade gas for free. So, and that happens each and every day. About 11 BCF a day moves physically on that system today, and that is financially traded 5 and 6 times each and every day. So somewhere in the order of 60 to 70 BCF a day is traded financially at the Alberta hub every day, and that makes it the most liquid hub in North America. And from the Alberta hub, there's access to all North American markets coast to coast on TransCanada's existing pipelines. I hope you noticed that on the earlier slide that I provided to you. You can move gas as far east as Boston and New York, all the way through the Midwest, of course, and as far west as the Pacific Northwest and into California. That is available to Alaskan Gas. That will be available to Alaskan Gas, just like it is to Western Canadian Gas today. And it is our forecast that by 2017, when Alaskan gas will flow, there will be spare takeaway capacity on those systems sufficient for the full Alaska volume. The current capacity of the pipelines leaving Alberta is approximately 15 BCF a day. And in 10 years' time, as a result of relatively flat to declining Western Canadian production, and also rising demand in Western Canada, there will be spare capacity on that system of about one-third of the existing capacity. Now, I will tell you, there will still be substantial, very significant volumes crossing the border from Canada into the United States. Canadian exports today are something in the order of 9 BCF a day, each and every day crossing the border. We think that those will be reduced by the time Alaskan gas flows. However, they will certainly not be reduced to zero. Canadian gas demand is increasing, but it's not contemplated it's going to increase by 9 BCF a day in the next decade, nor will the decline be in that magnitude either, either individually or sum. There will continue to be Canadian exports into the United States, and clearly Alaskan gas is targeted to go to the United States. Once it enters the Alberta hub, it would be commingled, as all the gas is, with the existing pipeline gas in Alberta. However, that there is not, and nor will there be, a new market for 4.5 BCF a day of Alaskan gas within Alberta. The growth in Alberta demand will be served by Alberta production, and the gas from Alaska will flow on through to U.S. lower 48 markets, as it has always been contemplated. But we believe, very frankly, that it will move on existing infrastructure. That is and will be the lowest cost alternative for Alaskan gas. TransCanada has indicated that for some 2 to 3 years now, and I can confirm for you today that a third-party study by the Canadian Energy Research Institute recently published has indicated and concluded exactly the same thing, that Alaskan gas will see a benefit, basically higher netbacks, lower costs, by integrating into the Western Canadian infrastructure as opposed to building a new pipeline directly to Chicago, or quite frankly, by incrementing the Alliance pipeline. That analysis is available from Siri. I believe they are selling that service, but it's certainly available to the public, and it has a very similar conclusion to TransCanada's own analysis, which we have completed over the last several years. Lastly, on this page, I would advise you that one-third of the Alaska pipeline is in service. It's in service as a pre-build. The pre-build was constructed to move Western Canadian gas in advance of the northern section of the project, originally completed in 1981-82 under the existing legislation in Canada called the Northern Pipeline Act, and it currently moves about 3 BCF each and every day. If I could ask Patty to turn to slide 6, please. This is the current project schedule. I don't intend to take you through this in detail.
Yeah, Mr. Palmer. Mr. Palmer, stand by, please. We have a question from Senator Wagner.
Yes.
Tony, one question. Going back to prior testimony, would you, before you leave the overall the line to the hub in Alberta, would you talk a little bit about the compressor stations and the need for how much compression it takes? And how many stations to do 4.3 BCF a day, and how many to put that up to 5.9?
I don't know that I have those numbers right at my fingertips, but they're in our application. And just as I go through here, I think what I will do is I will look that up for you, Senator Wagner, through the chair. As I recall, it's something in the order of, I certainly recall, 6 in Canada. And I will look for the exact number within Alaska and certainly relay that to you. But we would have very modest amount of compression, as I described to you, some 100,000 horsepower to move the initial 4.5 BCF a day. The fuel ratio at that level is somewhere in the 2.1 to 2.3% range, so a very modest level of compression. And as we continue to build up the facilities with expansions through 5.9 BCF a day, we would merely be adding compression. So no pipeline looping until we get beyond 5.9 BCF a day, if that addresses your questions. If you would like to know the specific number of compressors, I will have to undertake to provide that for you.
Yeah, it was 6 and 7 was your numbers. I just want to put that on the record because we heard in a prior testimony it took 71 compressor stations.
I can assure you it takes nowhere near 71 compressors to move this amount of gas through the pipeline that we have designed. As I recall, it's 6 in Canada, and I don't want to be misquoted, but I think it's 9 or 10 in Alaska. So it's in the order of 10 or 15, sorry, it's in the order of 15 to 20 compressors initially for 4.5 BCF a day. This is a design that we've had for several years, and I can assure you I have seen press reports on some of that testimony projecting that fuel ratios would be somewhere in the 8% range on the pipeline itself. That's just clearly wrong. There's significant fuel at the gas treatment plant, but if you're looking solely at the pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Alberta, as I described to you, it's somewhere in the order of 2.3% fuel for 4.5 BCF a day. Very modest fuel ratio.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Palmer, stand by one for an administrative announcement. Number one, we'd like to recognize Senator Thomas, who joined us some time ago. And Senator Thomas, to be quite frank, you've been such a regular, we were almost to hold a meeting up and worried about your health since you weren't here. But welcome. And Senator Terrio joined us semi-simultaneously, and Senator Stevens got here about 3 or 4 minutes after we got started. Welcome to you as part of the committee. Please continue.
Thank you. Patty, if I could ask you to turn to slide 6. As I described to you, I will just hit the highlights on the schedule. As we prepared our application last fall in November, we, of course, at that time did not know when or if a license would be granted. But in order to complete a schedule for any project, we must know the start date. So we made an assumption, and that assumption here in this application was that we would get a license in April. And all of the dates following on the schedule, of course, are triggered off that April time frame. I will tell you that there is some flexibility to move back day by day from April. However, we do need this summer field season to hold to an aggressive schedule that we have here. And if, for whatever reason, the license were not granted until later this year, well into the summer, we may well lose this field season. So that's significant, and I've advised parties privately of that, and I clearly wanted to say that publicly. We're familiar with Alaska weather. We're familiar with northern Canadian weather, and there are certain things that need to be done in the summertime. And so we're in the state's hands as to when an application may be recommended in the first case, and secondly, may be approved for a license. And that timing, of course, will drive the remainder of the schedule. But let me go forward and just address the schedule, assuming, as we did in November, that a license would be granted in April. In that circumstance, we could clearly get out in the field this summer, do the necessary field work. And we've indicated that we could significantly better the AGEA requirement of a 36-month time frame to conclude an open season. We've indicated that we can complete an open season by September of 2009, so 18 months after a license would be granted. We could do so, assuming that we can get this field season in this year. And I will tell you that I have seen speculation by parties in the press that somehow TransCanada is shortcutting that process. I'll tell you that's not the case in any way. At this point, TransCanada has what would be described in engineering terms as a Class 5 cost estimate. That is the norm at this stage. By the time we go to open season, we will have a standard Class 4 engineering estimate. This is our business. We've been looking at the Canadian side of this project, as many of you would know, for 30 years. We have significant and valuable information to use, and we understand how to do this. And, of course, once we get through a FERC certification process, we would have a Class 3 cost estimate at that time. Once again, pipeline standard, and we would be proceeding with the project, assuming we had customers. So quickly going back to the schedule, AGEA requires us to commit to an open season time frame. We have done so on an aggressive basis. They also require us to commit to a FERC pre-filing date. We have done so, once again, triggered off this spring approval license. We've indicated we would hold FERC pre-filing request in June of 2010 and FERC filing by December of 2011. We've had very preliminary discussions with FERC staff, and we understand that they may wish us to even advance the June 2010 for pre-filing, or at least start to have initial discussions with them in advance of that, and we're certainly prepared to consider that. Beyond that time frame, we were really in FERC's hands as to when they would provide a license. It's our obligation to file and request, but it's within the regulator's venue to decide if we've met the conditions, and in the event that we have, and on a timely basis, they will grant the license. If they do so, you can see that assuming we have customers and have achieved the regulatory approvals that we need to make the project proceed, the project would be in service in just under 10 years from now, by November 2017. I'll ask Patty to move forward to slide 7. I thought it would be interesting for parties to just see what TransCanada filed. TransCanada knew that we were going into a competitive process in November of last year. We did not know who would be filing, and so we had a decision to make, and that was, are we going to make an application in any fashion And secondly, if we did, would we be making what we believed, at least, was a complete or compliant application? We concluded that if we were going to file, we were going to do so on a basis that at least we judged were complete and would hopefully be judged to be so by the government of Alaska. TransCanada, as many of you would recall, was opposed last year to the provision requiring a company that had a failed open season to continue on to go through to the FERC certification process. We argued against that over the course of last spring, but the legislature at the end of the day passed a piece of legislation that indicated that was a requirement. So as we decided in the fall of 2007 whether or not we could make an application, that was a compromise that we had to resolve in our company that said that if we're going to do so and wish to have a compliant application, which we did, then we would have to compromise on that issue and agree to move forward beyond a failed open season in that event, if that occurs, and that's clearly not what we seek, and continue on through the FERC process. So we made that concession, and we decided to proceed. I won't take you through all of the items here, but I've tried to list the must-haves and indicate what our response has been. I think I've spoken to a couple of them, but let me just hit a couple of highlights for you. I think Senator Wagner's question went to expansions. We have a design that is best suited for 4.5 BCF a day of initial capacity. Clearly, the volumes that we get in an initial open season will be determinative of that final design. But in the event that we're successful in attracting that much gas, you have a very inexpensive pipeline to expand using compression only by about one-third of the volume. Once again, with rolled-in tolls, you've heard me testify, I think several of you have for years, that TransCanada's system in Canada and the Canadian norm is to have rolled-in tolls, and rolled-in tolls is simply an averaging of the original cost plus expansion. TransCanada is very familiar with that system, and that is the Canadian norm, and we were quite willing to proceed with the AGIA requirement, which is 115% of the initial tolls within the Alaska section of the project. We, as the pipeline sponsor, would put that forward, of course, to FERC, as required under AGIA.
Mr. Palmer,
with regard to the gas treatment plant, yep, as I described to you, it's our preference that third parties would build it, but TransCanada is prepared to go forward under that circumstance and build it if necessary.
Mr. Palmer.
Yes.
Yeah, Charlie Huggins here. Stand by when we have a question from Senator Wilikowski.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the rolled-in rates, are you, in your design, I noticed you have 48-inch line through Alaska, 48-inch line through Canada. Let's say that Alaska consumers decide they want to take half BCF per day at Delta. Are you, how would you take that into account? Would you take that into account in your design process right away, or would you attempt to later roll that in? Have you given that any thought?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, if we knew in advance, in effect at the initial open season or thereabouts, that Alaskans wished to take off 500 million a day at Delta Junction, and we knew, of course, what the volumes would be to Canada, we would take that into account in our initial design. In the event that the 4.5 were going to Alberta, plus a half BCF a day out at Delta, let's say, in that circumstance, we would still build exactly the same system I described, just we would have additional compressors north of Delta.
So if I could, Mr. Chair, so then the Alaska consumers would take that off at Delta, and there would be no rolled-in rates. That wouldn't count towards 115%, is what I'm getting at.
We have proposed, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, we have proposed that there would be a separate Alaska rate, in effect a rate that is a weighted average, if acceptable to FERC, of only the Alaska component of the pipeline for the average distance moved within Alaska. So if I could just use an example, if Alaska Gas on average moved 70% of the distance through Alaska, then Alaskan customers would pay for the gas treatment plant, of course, which they would be using, plus 70% of the initial cost of the Alaska component of the pipeline, relative to if a party were taking service at the Yukon-Alaska border, they would be paying 100% of the toll.
I have a couple questions, if I could, while we got them broken down here, Mr. Chair. So on distance-sensitive rates, my understanding is you intend to break them down by zone instead of by the actual distance. Is that accurate?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, it is our proposal, if acceptable to FERC, that within Alaska, as I described, we would provide a single toll for Alaska deliveries based on a weighted average distance. Now, if that turns out to not be acceptable to FERC, then we will go with a specific distance for every individual volume. There are really two methodologies in the pipeline business to move gas within a certain zone or a region. And let me just call it Alaska zone for the moment. One is to do what I described, which is a weighted average for all customers. And the other is to take the actual individual distance for every individual customer. Obviously, the former is a simpler format, and many parties believe a fairer format, but there are some people that prefer the individual distance for individual customers.
And I guess just the people in Fairbanks would be paying the same amount as the people in, say, Delta Junction or somewhere else further down the line.
If that single zone for Alaska, as we've described, were acceptable to Alaskans and were acceptable to FERC, the rate in Fairbanks or Delta or Tok would be the same.
Okay. And then just one other topic, Mr. Chair, if I could. Let's say that Alaska got together and Alaskan consumers, utilities, decided that we needed one BCF per day or more, 1.5 maybe, for in-state use, for petrochemical use, for natural gas use, for maybe an agrium-type industry, heating, et cetera, that would be a quarter of the throughput. Would you allow Alaska to take a BCF or 1.5 BCF per day at Delta Junction?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. Clearly, TransCanada is going to look to provide service to customers at the locations that they requested. I want to clarify perhaps your question and maybe address it in a couple of scenarios. We have described in our application that we think that economically the project works best if there's about 4.5 BCF a day moving to Canada. That's the tolls that I have provided to you. And if there are incremental volumes that go to Alaskans in addition to that, which we expect there will be, then that is not going to change the tolls very much for any party. If, however, let me just use your example. If 1.5 BCF a day were moved to a location in Alaska, and that meant that only 3 BCF a day were going to Alberta, then clearly the tolls that I've provided you to Alberta are too low, because we have lost significant economies of scale. We would only be moving 3 BCF downstream of whatever the Alaskan market is. And in that circumstance, we would have to look to see whether or not a 48-inch pipe is the right pipe downstream of the Alaska delivery point for if 3 BCF a day were only moving. And we'd clearly have to see if customers were prepared to pay that amount of money. But TransCanada does not propose to restrict customers as to where they go in any fashion. What we propose to do is to design a system to move the gas to the locations that customers request.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good. And Senator Stedman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Just while we're on the issue of rolled-in rates, could you remind us again the difference between how Canada's regulators and the U.S. regulators look at the return on equity that's allocated and maybe in your opinion, tell us why the U.S. doesn't do fully rolled-in rates while Canada does?
So really two questions there, Senator Steadman, through the chair. Let me address rolled-in rates first. Canadian regulators have for many years now, decades really, used a norm as rolled-in rates for any expansion. And that just means that the costs as they were before the expansion are rolled in or averaged with the costs of any expansion, whether the tolls go up or down or sideways. And there is no test, for example, that would say 105% or 115%. The tolls will go up or down based on really the type of facilities that are put in place and, quite frankly, the vintage of the facilities that they're being incremented to. And that has been the norm, and that's been a successful process for Canada, who, quite frankly, has a basin that has been the farthest from market in terms of the North American markets. That has been the model that Canada has used successfully for many years now. In the United States, the norm at FERC has been, certainly once again for many years, has been they roll in the tolls, they average the cost, if the costs go down. So if the rolled-in toll as a result of an expansion declines, then there is a rolled-in toll system. And in the event that tolls go up, sometimes there's a test of 105%, but not always. And generically, there has been, and if the tolls go up, they do not roll them in. They apply incremental tolls for the new customers. And there, I won't go through all of the rationales because there will be differences of opinion as to why FERC has chosen to do that. But that has been the norm. However, when the open season regulations were established for this project, some 3 or so years ago now, the FERC, when they were reviewing it, decided that they would go forward with a rebuttable presumption of rolled-in tolls for this project. And they, of course, will consider what the sponsor pipeline puts forward as well as what customers put forward. So that's the rolled-in difference in rolled-in tolls versus incremental in Canada and the U.S. Your second question, I think, dealt with return on equity. So return on equity in the United States versus Canada on most pipelines has been different for the last several years. Canadian pipelines have not, in many cases, not been at risk if they lose volumes on their systems. If they lose volumes on their systems, generally what happens in Canada is the amount of dollars to be collected is recovered from the remaining customers on the system. I wouldn't say that that's uniformly the case, but that's generally the case. And at least partially, that's a rationale why Canada has had a lower rate of return on their pipeline system. In the United States, generally, once again, I'll speak generally as opposed to specifically, in the event that a pipeline loses a customer from their system, they certainly, over a short period of time at least, until they have another rate case, they usually cannot pass that on through distribution to their existing customers. If the if many customers withdraw from their system, or then you usually will see an application by the pipeline to have different tolls in front of FERC. But U.S.-based rate of return on equity has usually been higher than Canadian pipes for the last several years, and in many cases, they're not required as U.S. pipes to come back for review of their rate of return on the same regular basis that Canadian pipelines have been required to. The National Energy Board in Canada for many years required Canadian pipelines to come back annually for a review of their rate of return. And as interest rates have generically fallen since periods of high inflation, that has meant annual reviews have generally resulted in lower rate of return as interest rates have fallen.
We have a question, Mr. Palmer, from Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the big concerns is cost overruns. And in the miles of pipe you've built, 36,500 worldwide and 12,000 in the United States. What has your company's experience been regarding cost overruns?
So Senator Welikowski, through the chair, I think I described for you, and I certainly testified to that, during the 1990s, we built 7,000 miles of pipe, some $14 billion worth of capital, and we did that on schedule and within 0.6% of budget. I think we have a formidable record of performing and constructing natural gas transmission lines in North America. We've built a number of pipes in other parts of the world as well. I wouldn't want to profess to you that we have a perfect record. I don't think any company does, and clearly I think we've all experienced cost increases in our estimates as there has been a heating up of the oil and gas business in the last few years. But TransCanada is very proud of its construction record and very proud of our results, which I have testified before in front of a number of committees in Alaska, and we're happy to compare our record in terms of controlling costs on pipelines with anyone in North America. In fact, I think the benchmarks would show you that TransCanada's record has been superior to other parties. But I will also indicate to you that we have heard that issue brought up by a number of parties, legitimately so, that TransCanada needs to be highly motivated, not just by reputation and credentials, to manage its costs. And as I flip through this presentation, I hope to highlight for you some specific incentives or disincentives for TransCanada that would motivate us directly to hit the cost target.
Okay, just quick follow-up on that. We just heard testimony a few days ago from CINEPEC regarding steel, and I think the testimony was for X75 steel, China was in a much better position to get about 800 miles worth of steel, and I think the testimony was that to get 1,700 miles for this line, it would take, and I think you're using X75 or X85, it would take about 10 years to get that steel. Do you see any problems getting the steel to build this pipeline?
Senator Welikowski, through the chair, I unfortunately did not hear that testimony, but I read a press report about it, and I think the witness testified to the use of X70 steel versus TransCanada's proposed X80. Let me just address that for the moment. And for those of you that are not don't spend their time in the pipeline business, X80 is simply a steel strength. It means the ultimate strength of the steel is up to 80,000 pounds per square inch. That today is a standard piece of pipe in TransCanada's system. We started using X80 pipe in 1993 or 1995. We have used it for more than a decade now. It is the norm, not used on all of our systems, but it is the norm as we construct pipelines. And in fact, we have more than 1,700 or 1,800 miles of X80 pipe in our operation today on our system. We have somewhere in the order of 1,500 to 2,000 miles of 48-inch pipe in the ground today. So we're very familiar with that steel strength. We're very familiar with large diameter pipe, and I am very confident that there will be the steel supply for X80 pipe for this system in the time frame that we have projected. I would not like to speak to someone else's testimony, but I can just tell you that TransCanada, as we prepared our bid, we specifically talked to a number of steel suppliers. Clearly at this point, because we're several years away from ordering pipe, you don't get specific pricing and you don't get specific commitments to supply you with pipe, but the interest is there to supply that pipe, and clearly the capacity is there to supply that pipe.
Yeah, and follow up, Mr. Palmer, Charlie Huggins. Do you have the source yet for Keystone steel?
In fact, we have sourced the supply for Keystone, and because that's an oil pipeline, Mr. Chairman, that actually runs at much lower pressure than a gas pipeline, and that's the norm. Oil pipes run at a lower pressure than gas. But yes, we have the steel supply for Keystone, and in fact, it is today that parties are experiencing the most challenges in obtaining pipe, just because of the massive expansions of natural gas pipelines in the lower 48, as well as the oil pipelines coming out of Canada. So it's actually very difficult today to source steel pipe for large projects, but we do have the steel supply for the pipe for Keystone.
Okay, thank you very much, and please continue.
So thank you. Patty, if I could ask you to turn to slide 8, and once again, I will flip quickly through the items under the must-haves, but I just wanted to show you that in TransCanada's view, we have met the requirement for all of these components, and we were gratified that the administration has concluded the same. I'm going to address some of these on the next page, but just to hit a couple of highlights, I think I've already addressed the in-state deliveries and in-state delivery rates. I think I've addressed that. I will come back and speak to the debt ratios and capital cost overrun on the next page. And clearly the local hire, local headquarters, et cetera, project labor agreement, we've agreed to all of those components. And the readiness financial resources I addressed at the beginning. So unless there are other questions on the specific must-haves, I'll ask Patty to turn to page 9, where I'll address how TransCanada decided to prosecute its application and go forward in the competitive environment of AGEA. Patty, on page 9, if you have that up, I did want to highlight for parties, because I've heard some comments once again in the press, that parties believe that AGEA has not been a competitive process. Well, as I sat in my office and as I went to my board in the fall of 2007, I expected there to be comprehensive competition. And that's clearly how TransCanada bid. We bid to win. We not only believed that we must submit a compliant application to jump the first hurdle, as it were, but also we fully expected to be in competition with other parties. And since this was a best and final offer that we would be putting forward, a single chance, as it were, we stretched in a number of ways to ensure that we would be very competitive. If we jumped the first hurdle and got to be deemed to be complete, as the state was evaluating or would have been evaluating at the moment, whether or not TransCanada had the best offer, we put forward a number of incentives, we thought, that would be attractive to Alaskans and clearly attractive to customers that would improve the likelihood of success and hopefully also improve the net present value of our proposal, which was the test that the administration would be applying. Let me take you through a couple of those. As I described for you, we think we have a very competitive system design. It is high pressure. It does use X80 pipe. That provides you with significant efficiency, both on fuel as well as steel. I described in response to Senator Wagner's question, the fuel ratio is very low for a 1,700-mile pipeline system. We've indicated that although we would prefer not to own the gas treatment plant, in the event that other parties do not wish to do so, either those producers or Alaska corporations of any sort or other corporations, then TransCanada will do so. And that's a step out for us, as you know, that longstanding we've wished to build a pipeline, but it has not been our preference to build that facility, but we're prepared to do so. We've heard clearly from a number of potential shippers that they would like to have the opportunity to own part of this pipeline. And we've indicated clearly in our initial open season that parties that commit a threshold volume will have that opportunity to become a partner in the project. We hope that that will be attractive to them. We hope that, that will help encourage them to commit their gas to the project. Once again, that was a stretch by TransCanada to make that offer. The next bullet on the page really addresses how the tolls will work in terms of our debt and equity structure. The requirement in AGEA is that a party has a minimum of 70% debt for the initial project, and I think that's primarily because there is going to be a U.S. government loan guarantee. That's really what permits the high debt ratio at this point on this type of a project. TransCanada has said we will apply the 70% debt ratio during construction, but on completion of the project, so before it goes in service, we will refinance 5% of that with debt. And you'll see here in my slide that that means a toll reduction of 9 cents per MMBTU. That's a very significant toll reduction for customers. Somewhere in the order of just under, just over 3%, very significant toll reduction. And that means that TransCanada and its shareholders have less equity supporting this project. That's something that you will find that pipelines are generally reluctant to do. We've done so to be competitive. We've also proposed, because just to follow up on Senator Walikowski's question about cost control, TransCanada is proud of its record. We think we have a very good record, and we think that since we not only want to move the initial 35 TCF of gas that's proven on the North Slope, we want to expand the system, we're highly incented to have low costs because we want, if we have high costs, it'll be much more difficult to attract new customers. However, we have heard from potential customers and others that they would like TransCanada to have direct financial incentives or disincentives if we overrun the cost. They want us to be aligned with them. So we have attempted to come up with a couple of proposals that do exactly that. And we've proposed in our application openly that in the event that we have a cost overrun, we will take up to a 2% reduction in our rate of return for the first 5 years of operation. Once again, a very significant hit on our bottom line as a company if we are to overrun the cost. And as we proposed in the application, that our rate of return would be triggered off 10-year Treasury notes. When I prepared this application in November, at that point it would have yielded some 14% return. And unfortunately, when I looked at the numbers this morning, that would have yielded some 13.25%. That's without this rate of return reduction. So yes, TransCanada will be highly motivated to ensure that we do the best job we possibly can to control costs. And the last item we proposed to align us on costs really takes me to the bottom of the page, which is the loan guarantee. So I want you to keep that in your mind as I'll come to that at the bottom of the page. Next, TransCanada was also interested in seeing if there wasn't something additional we could do to motivate this project to proceed in the first case, and secondly, to proceed through Canada and into our system. I described to you that we believe that the gas entering the existing infrastructure at the Alberta Hub is the most beneficial for Alaskans and for Alaska shippers, and certainly for Western Canadians. But we wondered if there wasn't something additional that we could put forward. I think I've described for a number of you in the past that in the event that Alaskan gas moves forward, goes into the Alberta system, the Alberta-BC border in volumes of 4.5 BCF a day, that will lower the tolls for all Western Canadian producers. And in the response I gave to Senator Stedman earlier today, I described for him that if the pipelines are refilled with not just Canadian gas, but with Alaskan gas as well, the toll structure in Canada would, in effect, pass that benefit through to the customers. It does not stay with TransCanada. In that circumstance, there would be toll reductions if that gas enters Alberta in the order of $10 billion in the first 15 years that Alaskan gas flows. That's a huge benefit. Even though Alaskans would also be sharing in that benefit by having a very significantly cheaper system relative to a bullet line to Chicago, Alberta producers, Western Canadian producers, would be benefiting by $10 billion. We said to ourselves, at this point, we don't know the project is going to proceed, we don't know that it's going to come through Canada, and we don't know that it's going to be integrated. To achieve all those things, perhaps Western Canadian producers should be prepared to share some of that $10 billion worth of value with Alaskans. And that's exactly what the Fort Nelson upside would do, is in the event that that were a successful structure, some $3 billion in the first 15 years of the 10 I described would be shifted to Alaskan producers, to Alaskan shippers, and away from Alberta shippers. That would still mean that Albertans are ahead by $7 billion, and it should help the project proceed in the first case. It should help the project come through Canada in the second case, and it should help the gas be integrated in our system in the third case. Once again, it's a competitive response that TransCanada is prepared to sponsor with our regulators, and if successful, the toll that I've given you earlier would be reduced by an additional 13 to 18 cents. So that's that reduction is not sitting in the tolls that I have described for you. That's an upside in the event that we were successful. The next bullet really addresses something that was, I will tell you, something that TransCanada has wrestled with for a very long time last fall. TransCanada, as you know, has been the proponent of the Alaska project through Canada and on to the lower 48 for many, many years now. And that is the traditional project we have pursued. That's the project that we continue to believe is the superior project for Alaskans and Canadians and certainly for our company. And we want the investment opportunity and we want the gas into our system. And I think that's significantly why we are inherently aligned with the people of Alaska, wanting this project soon and wanting it to come through our system and expand ultimately. However, we were well aware that there would likely be applicants in your AGEA process for an LNG alternative. And we wished to be competitive with those parties. And we've also heard speculation from certain parties in Alaska that perhaps there will not be sufficient gas committed to Canada. And in that circumstance, if TransCanada had only submitted an application proposing to move gas through Canada, if we had been chosen and then we had an open season and party did not wish the gas to come through Canada and wanted it to go to an LNG project, well, we would have a failed open season for that reason. So TransCanada decided in the fall of last year that we would put in an LNG alternative. The bulk of our application does speak to the Canadian project. That is what we believe is the superior project. However, we specifically indicated that in the event that insufficient gas is committed to come through Canada to make that project economic, and if sufficient gas is committed to Valdez, we use this as a proxy for an LNG project, then we would be prepared to build a pipeline to that point and the gas treatment plant as well if necessary. We did not do economics on liquefaction or ships or regas facilities or markets. We thought that in the event that customers wanted that service, they'd be in a position to do that. So that was a significant stretch for us as well. And lastly on this page, we were asked under AGEA to look at ways to improve the probability of success of the project. And these are not conditions to our application, and I will speak to that later in my presentation, but they are what we hope are creative concepts that could assist the project, improve the likelihood of success. Because we too have heard that perhaps TransCanada will do its best in the course of the next several months and years if we're granted a license, but perhaps parties will not commit their gas in an open season, despite the initiatives that I've described to you on this page and earlier. And so we tried to determine how we could more closely meet the needs of customers. And I'll speak to the loan guarantee first, because that was another initiative that we put forward to try to better align ourselves with potential customers and others that may be concerned about TransCanada's commitment to cost control. We have heard parties indicate that TransCanada, if you overrun the cost, well, you just make more money. Well, I have a couple of comments on that. Firstly, we look to make a rate of return, not just more dollars. And so we're very focused, like any company is, on the actual rate of return. And as I described to you earlier on this page, we would see a penalty in our rate of return if we have a cost overrun. But I hear that issue, that customers do not want TransCanada to make extra money in the event that there's a cost overrun. So our proposal here is the U.S. government approved a significant support proposal for the project through the loan guarantee 4 years ago, I guess 3.5 years ago at this point, for an $18 billion loan guarantee. We've suggested that if a component of that $18 billion could be allocated to cover any potential cost overruns, that would mean a number of things. Firstly, debt financing for overrun is, of course, the cheapest form of financing, cheaper than debt and equity, and certainly cheaper than equity alone. Secondly, it would mean TransCanada is not investing another dollar nor receiving another dollar for any cost overruns. In fact, we have a penalty from that rate of return hit I described earlier. And thirdly, if the U.S. government were prepared, and we hope they would be prepared, to recover their monies from any cost overruns, only in the event of a surcharge in the toll when gas prices at a hub, let's say the Alberta hub for the moment, but it could be farther downstream in the lower 48, is above a certain threshold level, that would mean that customers, potential customers, would have a concrete view as to what the toll would be, and it would only be higher in the event of an overrun and also reasonably good gas prices. That should be very attractive for a customer who is looking at committing his gas and committing his credit to this project. We hope that that will be creatively looked at by the U.S. government, and quite frankly, hopefully it will be supported by the government of Alaska in terms of going with us to Washington to propose this in the event that we're granted a license. But it is not a condition. And the second concept that's on this page deals with the bridge shipper concept. And that is, if despite our best efforts and despite the best efforts of Alaskans and others, the parties that currently control the gas and, quite frankly, other potential shippers, just at the end of the day, do not commit their gas in an open season, is there another way to advance the project? And we said, well, you've heard me testify in the past that this project needs customers and or credit in order to advance. Not to advance through FERC certification, because AGEA requires a compliant applicant to complete that. But to actually construct a pipeline, anyone needs customers or credit. So we creatively said to ourselves, where is a party that has the credit to support this? And quite frankly, that may have the wish from a policy standpoint to see this project go forward. And we thought perhaps the U.S. government would be prepared to supply more support for the project by, in the event that there is a failed open season, that the U.S. government would be prepared to step up, sign the long-term gas transportation agreement, in effect, commit to advance the project, ensure it's going to go forward, and meet the 2017 in-service date, which is, we think, would break open the largest stranded domestic storehouse of gas in the United States. The U.S. government has been supportive in the past of this project, and perhaps is prepared to do more. I'll speak to that a little bit more on the stage. But that's a concept that we wanted to put forward as something that should be considered by the government of the United States. It would mean there is significantly longer time frame for the existing parties that are leaseholders to consider whether or not they wish to commit their gas to the project. That may be beneficial to them. Secondly, it would give the opportunity for parties who are not that active looking for natural gas today because they're not sure of the timing of a pipeline. If they were assured that a pipeline was going to be in service in 2017, we would expect them to ramp up their activities as well. And lastly, if you think this project is going to be in the money, and I'll show you some current economics here shortly, the gas does not need to be found on the North Slope today. There's 8.5 BCF a day being produced each and every day. It's a very different circumstance than a basin that has no gas production. So we wanted to put it forward. We know that the U.S. government has been supportive in the past of public infrastructure. They've been supportive of highways and railways and airports, et cetera. And they've clearly been supportive of domestic gas production. They provided Section 29 tax credits for coal bed methane and for tight gas, shale gas, for some 15 years to the amount of $1 per MMBTU for some 15 years. And today, as you move through 2010, it's expected that those two sources of gas, which are generally termed to be unconventional gas, will be approximately 50% of domestic production by 2010. So, although those tax credits have been controversial in the past, in some forms, they, at the moment, appear to be producing, at least to some degree, have supported the development of those domestic sources of gas. We think that this project, the Alaskan Gas, what is missing is the pipeline, not a tax credit for the actual gas, but support for the pipeline. And in the event that the other initiatives that we put forward, and that others put forward as well, including the government of the United States, if they are not sufficient to make the project go forward, we wanted to put this proposal in front of the government of the United States to see if they were prepared to consider it. At this point, we haven't done so. We've had very preliminary discussions with some staffers, but we're not a licensee at this point, and until we are, we're not in a position to make an ask in Washington, and we know that this would be something that would have to be considered for a considerable period of time. Once again, not a condition of our application. Just ask if there are any questions on this page before I flip to the next one.
Go ahead and proceed.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead and continue.
Thank you. Slide 10. So on slide 10, we were provided by the state with a number of economic assumptions, and there were other assumptions that TransCanada had to make in order to complete an analysis of this project. So understand that this page is based on those assumptions, and of course, if those assumptions turn out to change, then you'll, of course, reach different conclusions. But the state advised us that we were to use the U.S. EIA gas price forecast for the project. We, of course, had to bring that back to an Alberta price. But in 2018, in nominal dollars, so dollars of the year, that's about $6.50 in Alberta. And that coincidentally is about what gas prices are this winter in Alberta. They're running between $6 and $7. So that assumes, if this forecast is correct, that there's no inflation in gas prices over the course of the next decade. And then to the right of that, you will see the annual average over the course of 25 years. You can see that they've got gas prices escalating from there. I've shown just below that the pipeline plus the gas treatment tolls that you've seen in my application. First year, including fuel, $2.76. And to the right of that, the reason the number goes up over time is because fuel prices, of course, are driven off the U.S. EIA gas price forecast. The actual pipeline toll is actually flat in nominal dollars at $2.41, but the fuel component goes up as gas prices go up. I would tell you that if you look at those numbers, just before we move to the bottom section, just look at the first year of in-service. Take 653 and deduct the 276. So if the gas price forecast is correct, and if our costs are accurate, there would be about a $3.75 netback for producers. for the gas they're currently producing at Prudhoe Bay and other gas that might come into that pipeline system. Now, from that $3.75, producers would clearly have to pay their own production costs and take their profits, of course, as they should, as well as share with the state and other tax-collecting bodies to be able to come up with net amounts. And down below, I've once again tried to calculate stakeholder value using the formulas and using the methodologies that the state described for us, and in certain cases we had to make some assumptions. So down below you will see the total numbers that that we've described in our application, but I wanted to just translate the numbers into dollars per year so that you could see how significant the benefits will be if the gas price forecasts turn out to be accurate and the cost of the project are as well. Very significant benefits for the producers after they've paid their taxes. They, of course, will still have to take cover their production costs and other costs out of those revenues and then take their profits. But I also wanted to point you to the state of Alaska numbers. $2.5 billion in the first year, and I will tell you these are direct dollars. These are direct dollars from the gas production as well as from the pipeline. So they're everything from the royalties and taxes you collect as well as income taxes and property taxes and other revenues that you would receive. That $2.5 billion, if I were to use a number of approximately 600,000 Alaskans, that translates in the first year to something in the order of $4,000 per year. If you move to the right and take the annual average of $4.6 billion, once again, that in round numbers, that turns out to be about $7,500 per person per year, a very significant upside for Alaskans, just like you receive today on the oil side. Down below, I've illustrated for you the U.S. government numbers, smaller but still significant, and TransCanada's numbers, because the pipeline depreciates over time, we would receive more money in the first year than we actually do on average, because, of course, by the last year, we would have a fully depreciated pipeline. I will also tell you that these numbers assume no expansion of the pipeline, ever. So it just assumes there's an initial 4.5 BCF a day in the pipeline. Never an expansion. In our application, we actually provided some numbers for expansions, and they're available in that application. And these are not indirect numbers for the value of employment and exploration, etc. Strictly for moving the existing volumes, the 4.5 if they're committed to the pipe, and for also for collection of taxes on them. So that's just a quick overview of the application. I did also want to address some questions that we have seen come up in a number of committees or have been reported in the press. And I'll just touch on those if I could on slide 11. They go to the relative timing of the Alaska and Mackenzie project. I have separate slides on each of these. Is TransCanada the GIA application conditional on U.S. government support for the bridge shipper and loan guarantee concept? Is the AGEA project subject to ANNGTC, that's the original partnership's historical liability? And what is TransCanada's position regarding upstream fiscal terms? And with your indulgence, I'll move forward to slide 12 and try to respond to these individually. Alaska Mackenzie timing. So currently, the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline, which, as you know, is a pipeline to move northern Canadian gas, is scheduled to be in service by 2014. TransCanada currently plays a modest role in that project, a very small participant in the project. We have the right to own approximately 5% of that project. The proposed schedule for the Alaska pipeline, our proposed schedule, would be to be in service in 2017. So you can see that there's a three-year gap. In fact, if those target dates can be achieved for both projects, there's significant opportunity for equity and labor synergies and cost savings on the Mackenzie project and on the Canadian section of the Alaska pipeline. In the event that those projects stay on those schedules, at least on the Canadian side of the Mackenzie, which is all Canadian, as well as the Canadian side of the Alaska project, there is significant opportunity to make the use of the same equipment and much of the same labor. Clearly, the requirement for labor on the Alaska project is much higher than it is on the Mackenzie. And Alaskan labor will be required for the Alaskan component of the project, clearly, as always contemplated. But the Canadian section of the project could make significant use of that labor and of that equipment. We think that would be very attractive and would lower the cost of the project. On the next page, how could the U.S. government support the project? I hope I've been clear that these are ideas we've put forward to improve the probability of success of the project, not conditions to our application. So in the event the U.S. government decides they do not want to pursue these ideas, or they want to pursue others, or none at all, then TransCanada will continue to move forward and meet the requirements of its application under AGIA. That is something that we're obliged to do under AGIA. With a compliant application, that is something we will proceed with. However, we do believe that this is a positive for the project, and I think that something we should be considering. I think I've addressed these issues. I won't take you through in detail. Turn to page 14, please. TransCanada is a GIA applicant. So the applicants are Foothill Pipelines in Canada. That's the traditional applicant for the project that owns the Canadian assets. There are no significant issues there, have never been on that. In fact, there are benefits to the project proceeding under that act because we have a single window regulatory agency. But I did want to address quickly the entity that we've put forward in Alaska. And that is TransCanada Alaska Company, LLC. I want to address that issue because I know it has come up in a number of parties. That is a separate legal entity from the original partnership. There's no liability to ANNGTC or the withdrawn partners by that entity. We're going for a new start in Alaska. We're not proposing utilization of any ANNGTC assets, not the certificates, nor the right-of-ways, nor the permits, or the engineering, or the geotechnical. And our cost estimates and our schedule assumes we're starting from scratch, in effect taking a very conservative view. And our application commits to never including any potential ANNGTC liability in a GIA project toll. That's what we think customers are concerned about, if at all. And it also is what we think Alaskans would be concerned about, if at all. That tells you how confident TransCanada is in its legal position when we're prepared to make that commitment, that we will not put those obligations, if they ever come home, to TransCanada, which we do not think they will, into the toll. Slide 15, and I'll just wrap up here quickly. The original partnership was formed in the 70s. All those partners have withdrawn except two TransCanada subsidiaries. Those subsidiaries are not the AGIA applicants. TransCanada and ANNGTC decided in the fall of 2007 that was not a viable entity to prosecute the project. ANNGTC and the existing subsidiaries have no duties to withdrawn partners, current or future. There is no liability today. They don't owe no duty to the withdrawn partners, and those withdrawn partners forfeited the rights to be treated as a partner. In fact, those of you that have looked on the state's website would know we filed the partnership agreement. Those withdrawn partners are only entitled to a contractual right to payment if and when ANNGTC builds the pipeline. Well, they're not going to build the pipeline. And secondly, if the payment would not pose an undue hardship on ANNGTC, there's no duty to pursue the project on behalf of the withdrawn partners, and no TransCanada entity is prohibited from pursuing a different project. So with the new piece of legislation that was passed 3.5 years ago called the Enabling Legislation, or ANCPA, which is what our application is going forward under, any party can do that. TransCanada as well is not precluded. Page 16, upstream fiscal terms. Clearly, our obligations are not conditional on a review of the upstream fiscal terms. We acknowledge that this issue is between the state and producers. We do request that the state resolve upstream fiscal terms for natural gas prior to the initial open season. We hope to hold that open season in the summer, fall of '09, and that would mean that in the event that the state of Alaska decides that it needs to change in some fashion its natural gas production tax or other upstream regime, that it could review it next year in your regular session or at another period. Next steps,
yes,
on page
Mr.
17.
Palmer, Mr. Palmer, stand by. We have a question from,
yes,
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. When you say resolve upstream fiscal terms, are you saying that there something needs to be changed? When I look at your calculations, you have producers earning an average of $7.3 billion per year. Not before upstream costs, of course, will be lower. But I guess in your experience, are Alaska's upstream terms, do they need to be fixed?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I'm not really in a position to comment on your upstream fiscal terms for natural gas. All we would ask is that the state of Alaska has considered what you have in place and is either confident that you have an appropriate system by the time we have an initial open season, or you've undertaken to review it by that time. I'm not in a position to comment on whether or not you have an attractive system at this time or not. Our analysis that I use, we strictly, when we analyzed that, we made an assumption. And if those of you that looked in the body of our application, our assumption was that there was an upstream gas production tax of 25% flat. And I know that that's not the structure you have today. You have some progressivity. But for simplification, that's what we use for analysis, and what we use for analysis for upstream gas production costs, which, once again, we have no knowledge of. We assumed that that was $1.50 plus inflation. So I guess I would advise you that it is the state legislature and the administration that has a better view of that than perhaps I would, and clearly a better view as to what costs are upstream than TransCanada has.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Palmer. And Senator Stedman has a question.
Well, Mr. Palmer, then apparently you must think it's an obstacle, or you wouldn't have even addressed it in that manner.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, we have listened to the debate in the public as to whether or not there is an appropriate level of taxation on upstream. We've heard from both sides in the press as to where they are, and all we're suggesting is that the parties that are most affected by this, which are the state and the producers, I think have expressed themselves at least publicly as to where they might be, and we're asking that the state at least consider whether or not it believes it has an attractive system. We're not here to advise you as to what that may be, and we're not here to advise you as to how or whether you wish to do that. But we do want to know that by the time we hold an open season, that has at least been considered.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Palmer. Let me just for so we all understand that we. Given the scenario you described, we essentially have about a 15-16-month window if we're going to address the issue under discussion. Is that accurate?
Yes. If there's a license granted in April of this year, yes, we would be holding an open season in the summer, fall of 2009. Yes,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Next steps on slide 17. I'll just go quickly through that. I think everyone's very familiar with that. Public comment continues through March the 6th. Subsequent to that, the administration will make a recommendation in some period of time. At this point, certainly TransCanada is not aware of how long that will be. And subsequent to that, if there's a positive recommendation, the legislature will review and make a decision regarding approval or not. And looking at the schedule, not knowing the timing for administration and for the legislature, we've suggested that perhaps there will be an AGEA license granted or not, in Q2 of this year. It still looks to be achievable in that time frame. Just to summarize on page 18, I wanted to just wrap up for you. Last year, the administration and the legislature established the GIA as your transparent process to advance the gas pipeline project. TransCanada submitted a thorough, creative, competitive, and complete the GIA application. We have the credentials and capacity to build, own, and operate and expand the project. If selected as a licensee, our obligations are not conditional on the U.S. government approving the bridge shipper or loan guarantee concept, nor on the state renegotiating upstream fiscal terms. The proposed TransCanada project will not be saddled with a $9 billion liability. The AGIA applicants have committed that in the unlikely event there ever is any liability, it will not be included in the project total. Thank you for your attention, and I'd be pleased to take any additional questions you have.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Palmer. Senator Wagner has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Palmer. I started off with 11 questions. You've answered 9 of them. So
good.
But when one other person came before us and testified about a week and a half ago, they testified that they would rather have a later open season rather than one that commenced 18 months after licensing by the state of Alaska. And one of the reasons they said they would rather have that, and I'm sure their time crunch was partially to blame for them making that statement, because they're currently exploring on the slope for gas. But the other thing they said is the later the open season, the more accurate the tariff will be. Is that correct?
Senator Wagner, through the chair. So a couple of responses to that, because I think there are two questions there. TransCanada believes that Alaska very much wants to see its project move forward as expeditiously as possible. We clearly do as well. And that's the reason why we believe that moving forward quickly to an open season is appropriate. We have committed as a company to hold open seasons every 2 years after the initial open season. So in the event that a party was unable to commit in that initial open season and was able to 2 years later, we, depending on the initial volumes and the incremental volumes, we may still be able to accommodate them in the initial capacity of the pipeline. I can't guarantee that, but clearly we would look to that. Secondly, would there be a better set of costs if we wait another year or two? I would suggest to you there will not be. The same amount of work needs to be done. Spreading it out over a longer period of time generally does not accelerate the project. The concern on this project has always been, after you have a successful open season, there's still a period of about 8 years to become in service. So if we deferred the open season, and we therefore deferred the rest of the schedule as well, all that would happen is the project would be moved back a year or two. I don't think that's to anyone's benefit.
Senator Wagner, follow-up.
No, just one other question. And this has to do with the question I've heard the answer to before, but I think the public needs to understand the answer to this question, Mr. Palmer. And that's, why do oil and gas producers generally not like to own or operate pipelines, or is that changing today?
Senator Wagner, through the chair. Traditionally, I'll speak to the gas side first. Traditionally, gas pipelines in North America have been owned and operated, built, owned, and operated by independent pipelines. That is the norm across North America. However, there are certain instances where producers have decided that they want to commit their equity to own and build the pipeline. They are relatively rare, but there are certainly instances that we can all describe where that has occurred. Most producers have a cost of capital that is higher than a pipeline company. Their equity shareholders look for a higher rate of return than you can obtain on a pipeline. And that circumstance usually leads them to want to invest their monies in riskier projects, generally exploration and development of gas and or oil. Pipeline companies like ours are very pleased to get a regulated rate of return that has relatively low variability. And our shareholders reward us for finding investment opportunities that often take a lower rate of return, but also have lower variability or lower volatility than exploration and production companies. That has traditionally been the reason why producers have not sought to own pipelines. And the second reason has been that in most basins, there is not a controlling producer or a controlling group of producers. There's usually many tens and sometimes many hundreds of producers. So bringing that group of producers together to own a pipeline is often much more complex than it would be if you had two or three producers. In the circumstances where you do have two or three producers that control the leases or production for the majority of the gas, governments are often very motivated to ensure that they have instituted rules that will ensure that other parties can become shippers on the pipeline that is constructed beyond those initial shippers on a fair and open basis. And I think that those are the primary reasons why you have not seen gas pipelines owned by E&P companies over time.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Senator Wilikowski?
Thank you. You're obviously, TransCanada obviously is a very successful company. You didn't get that way by building pipelines to areas where you couldn't get gas. How confident are you that you will be able to fill the pipeline with gas and
Senator
you'll have
Wilikowski,
a successful open season?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, thank you for that question. I will tell you that that's an issue that we wrestled with mightily through the fall of 2007 and earlier as we pursued this project. TransCanada, as you have seen, if you've looked at our estimates, is believes that it will cost north of $600 million to go through the open season and the FERC certification process. And we understand and appreciate that the government of Alaska is prepared to contribute a significant share of that, but when you look at the potential upsides for Alaska as well as for TransCanada if we own the pipeline, you can see that there's a significant difference in what the upsides are for Alaska versus TransCanada. So when we consider this, we first looked at the macroeconomic issues on the project. In order to advance any project, you need to at least believe that the project is economic. And so we looked at gas price forecasts. We looked at what we believe we could build this project for. We looked at the variability of supply from different basins, not just domestically but internationally, moving gas to the lower 48 in Canada as to whether or not we thought Alaskan gas could compete. We looked at the demand side as well. So that was the first thing we examined. Second thing we examined is the commitment of governments to advance this project. This is a project that no company, no commercial company, can advance on their own. And this is not unusual. It doesn't make Alaskan pipeline any different than any other long line new basin pipeline. No company can do that alone. No company owns the land between Prudhoe Bay and the lower 48. They need cooperation from governments. And it has been our assessment that when we looked at the commitment of the administration and the legislature last year to pass AGIA, and the expression by a number of parties publicly over the last several years, we believe Alaskans very much want to see this project proceed and proceed expeditiously. We think there's support from the U.S. government as well. We think that Canada will be committed to advance the project. Canada clearly has obligations to the United States in a treaty for this specific project. So that was a consideration. And then we looked at the micro economic components of the project. Does TransCanada have the credentials and capability to advance this project? And can we put forward proposals that we think will be acceptable, not just to producers and other potential shippers, but that will be attractive to governments. And when we considered all of those things, we decided to risk our time, money, and talent to advance the project.
Okay. Senator Stedman?
I just got a couple of questions here, Mr. Chairman. And yeah. I know it's getting late, so I'll try to make them brief. But if we could, Mr. Palmer, if we could roll back the your presentation to the very beginning when you talked about the structure of TransCanada. TransCanada does more than just gas lines. Isn't it involved in power generation also, which is a fairly substantial portion of your business?
It is, Senator Stedman, to the chair. TransCanada has been a pipeline company for some 50 years. Our electricity generation business is a much younger component of our business, but it's growing, and in fact, today is between one-third and 40% of our business.
Okay. And could you talk a little bit about, I just kind of wrote these questions down as we were rolling through it, so I'll just kind of roll them out as they appeared, but could you address a little bit about the potential of getting awarded the AGIA license, progressing on through an open season and possibly past a failed open season to the FERC certificate, at the same time when you may have another entity going outside of AGIA to the FERC for that certificate, and how TransCanada would handle that risk exposure?
Senator Stedman, through the chair. So our obligation, if we're granted the AGIA license, is to proceed to hold an open season, to do the necessary work to do that. We have described in our application what that will involve. Everything from field work through environmental and engineering and other analysis to be able to put forward a solid offer to customers. We will do that. In the event that that open season is unsuccessful, despite our best efforts and the best efforts of governments generally, and if the U.S. government does not play the roles that we've described and there is no other credit, then we will, of course, be moving forward to FERC pre-filing and FERC certification. At the moment, we're not aware that there is another party that has put forward or intends to put forward a FERC application. I don't think there's any party that has that obligation. We certainly have heard certain parties indicate that they may wish to do so if they had a fiscal arrangement on upstream with the state of Alaska. But at the moment, we're not aware that there's another party that has a proposal to go to FERC.
So I take that as your opinion is there's no risk exposure to you or the state under that scenario.
I'm sorry. I certainly would not like to leave you with the impression that there's zero risk exposure. There always is risk, and I think that, but I am not aware at the moment that there is another party considering that. In the event that there were, in what I consider to be the unlikely event at the moment, because I have not heard statements by third parties that they intend to go forward, but if they did, then clearly FERC would have to consider either a competitive process at that point, or whether or not they're prepared to grant more than one certificate.
If we can go to slide number six.
Yes.
Slide number six is the timeline, and could you, there's a couple things in here that I don't see. One of them is the potential litigation to get access to the gas in the event that you don't have enough quantities to make your proposal viable. I'd like you to address that. Isn't apparent in there? And then also on the mega projects around the world, my understanding is they go through what they refer to a lot of times as gates or decision points before they recommit then to proceed to the next one to make sure their project is on task and it's not going to derail. And clearly with a project of $25 to $30 billion or more, why would your proposal not have any any gates. It just appears to me that we grant you the certificate, and then we show up in 2017 with our bank wiring instructions.
Senator, your statement through the chair. Let me respond to the second one first. Clearly, if you are familiar with the details of our application, that is not what we're proposing. We are obliged, pursuant to AGEA, to move forward through FERC application and filing. That's an obligation. So at the moment, there are not stage gates up to that point. TransCanada will be obliged to proceed through that, whether or not we have a successful open season. However, we're not obliged to build the pipeline. That is not what AGEA requires. If we have customers, and in the event that we have met those tests, then we do have stage gates. And in fact, they're in our application. But those stage gates follow after we have met the obligations under AGEA. The second component is whether or not the state will decide to pursue other actions to obtain the gas if it's not committed. Clearly, that's the state's purview, not in mine. Is we do have the obligation to go through the open season. We have the obligation to continue on through FERC certification. We will do that. What the state may be doing in the event that there's a failed open season is clearly an issue that the state will decide on. TransCanada is not a party to that. We will be very interested, and we'll continue to seek customers, as we've described in our application, but we're not a party to how that will occur. But TransCanada is not going to complete the project in 2017 if we have no customers or no credit. AGEA does not require it, and our application does not contemplate that.
Okay. And then one last thing, Mr. Palmer, it's always interesting in the open process and bidding and in the competitive arena, it appears that we only have one project, which is TransCanada's, or one proposal, TransCanada's proposal that met the criteria and came forward. So we don't really have competing projects at all comply under AGEA. So can you help me sort through how we would do a fiscal comparison to make sure that your proposal is actually in the best interest of the state and it or not? How do we benchmark this to protect ourselves?
So Senator Stedman, through the chair, as I described to you, I tried very extensively to describe to you the competitive forces that TransCanada was feeling as we went through the fall. And we put forward a proposal, which you have in your hands now, at least the administration does at this point, which we clearly competed. And that's the norm in an RFP process. We've participated in many of those across the world. I personally have competed in upwards of 20 or 30 of them, and the competition usually occurs in advance of the submission by any party, because you, of course, are not aware as to what the other parties are going to be putting forward. And so if you want to win, you must put your best foot forward, your best and final offer, or you risk losing what may be a very good project for you. So that has occurred. TransCanada has competed. TransCanada has put forward its proposal. Clearly, we understand that the state may wish to consider what others submitted. They're all public. They're all available for you to review. I think they're available on the state's website. I think the requirement, as I recall from AGEA, is that this sufficiently maximizes the value to, I don't recall if it's Alaska or Alaskans, but if you consider our application and you consider the proposal we have put forward, I think you have a strong competitive proposal in front of you. And if you were to examine what other parties put forward, you will at least have those benchmarks to review against. And as I've described to you, we have offered in our application, we have described our credentials, we've described our record, and clearly you're in a position, either the legislature or the administration, to test the assumptions that were put forward by the administration or by TransCanada.
One more follow-up. Mr. Palmer, You know, as we have worked on this project the last couple of years, there's, you know, there was discussion from some groups that, you know, some people felt they were the only ones that can construct a particular project, and others, you know, others had different opinions, but clearly TransCanada has the ability to handle this project once we have gas committed to, so we can get the financing. I think you've expressed that, and looking at your company, you know, it certainly appears that way. But isn't the biggest advantage TransCanada has in getting a GEA license is to actually be in the mix when the agreements come together to access this gas with the three major producers, and that TransCanada or whoever the pipeline entity would have been, if it wouldn't have been TransCanada, would have been at a disadvantage being, so to say, out of the room or out of the mix during the discussion, that this AGEA license actually puts you in an attractive position when this process takes place?
Thank you, Senator Devin, through the chair. Thank you for your confidence that TransCanada is in a position to construct the project if the gas is committed. I hope that we continue to convince Alaskans that that is the case. TransCanada, as you've heard me express for many years now, believes we continue to have a strong position in the project in Canada because of our traditional rights and our traditional position. But we also were aware that this is the process that Alaskans have chosen. Alaskans have chosen the AGEA process. Both the administration and the legislature last year strongly ratified this approach to go forward. And this structure was the mechanism used by the legislature to advance the project. There wasn't another proposal and another methodology for TransCanada to participate in. So you've heard me testify for several years that we think there should be a reconciliation on a coming together of the three producers, the state, and TransCanada. We have thought that for several years. And you've seen in our application now that we have proposed that parties that commit their gas in the initial open season will have the opportunity to have equity in the project. We still believe that there's a mechanism that can be used through that structure in the initial open season to see initial shippers become equity owners, if that's the case. That's clearly what we seek, is we seek to see the project go forward with base shippers committed to the project.
Could I just clarify that? Maybe I garbled up the question because it's getting late in the day. Mr. Palmer, I didn't ask the question in the framework of you know, being taken back that TransCanada applied. I'm actually glad they did. Just trying to look at the value, and clearly I think as a pipeline company in your position, certainly in your best interest to apply and work with the state under whatever framework, as long as it's reasonable that the state puts forward. But just trying to look at, you know, where's the value created in the process, and what is the value of holding that a GEA license? And it appears to me that there is value for a pipeline company to have that license, to be in the center of the mix when the structure goes together, versus being outside of it under under the previous administration. Pipeline company is in a better position to protect its own interest.
And Senator Stedman, through the chair, I'm sorry if I did not understand your question earlier. Clearly, TransCanada did decide that although we were going to risk significant time and money and talent, we decided that it was a good investment of our money to participate in the AGEA process, hoping that we would win. And we're doing so hopeful that there is sufficient value for the investment we're making, and that we can make this project a success.
Okay. That's all I have.
Okay. Other questions, Mr. Palmer? Mr. Palmer, thank you very much. Are you in Seattle Airport now?
I am, Senator Huggins, and thank you for your indulgence, and I do intend to make my way to Juneau in the morning.
Oh, very good. Well, we look forward to seeing you, and thanks for your can-do spirit of making your presentation.
Thank you, and I very much appreciate you allowing me to do it over the telephone.
Yes, thank you. And I would like at this time to recognize in the communications business, Mr. Burnett's here from administration, that we have had some success communication with administration in this case, where we shared attorney opinions on TransCanada's application and thoroughness and things of that nature, Mr. Mogale, and we got some feedback. So I say thank you for that, Jerry, from the committee. And with that, we're adjourned.